Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, it's a potpourri of stories that ended up on the cutting room floor. We got a lot of phone calls this weekend on our weekend program. We invite you to call 888-302-3684 during show hours, or if you've got questions, you want to pose questions directly to us, you can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and they'll become grist for the mill for our weekly feature Q&A with Layla, wherein you'll get your questions answered. Some of these stories that I wanted to share with you last weekend got crowded out, and I thought they were worthy of airing. So we've added a special Intelligent Medicine Podcast to get those stories to you. So here goes. Okay, if you get lung cancer, if you should be so unfortunate as to develop lung cancer, maybe the last thing you think you need to worry about is air pollution. You know, after all, you already have lung cancer, right? So what could be worse? I mean, it's sort of like saying, I met a patient like that early in my career while training at the Manhattan VA. He had laryngeal cancer, which was caused by his smoking, and he'd had his larynx removed. And you know what happens when you see these anti-smoking commercials, these guys have little holes in their neck and they have like a little cloth thing that covers them and they kind of look like this, sort of an electronic voice amplifier. Literally we'd catch him smoking through this little hole in his neck. Because he was so, you know, he figured, hey, you know, my chances are nil, I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well enjoy my creature comforts. So you might think that, well, you know, I got cancer anyway, air pollution, that's a minor factor. Yeah, I live in the L.A. smog basin, or I live in the industrial northeast. That's not a biggie, because I got bigger problems than just a little air pollution. I got cancer now. Okay, interesting study. Researchers examined air pollution exposures and outcomes among more than 350,000 residents of California diagnosed with lung cancer between 1988 and 2009. That's a terrible statistic. 350,000 people diagnosed with lung cancer during just a couple of decades. Actually, in this case, three decades. Check it out. They found shorter average and 5-year survival times among those with higher exposures to each of four measured air pollutants. And the trend was strongest among patients with early stage disease that might have been curable, because late stage disease is very hard to treat. So the researchers say, we know that smoking is really the key risk factor for lung cancer, but we wanted to see if air pollution may be another modifiable risk factor for survival. And indeed, they found that there was up to 38% increased risk of death based on the amount of air pollution that you were exposed to. So, you know, they talk about California and how onerous the regulations are in terms of air quality. But I grew up in Southern California in an era where, you know, you cut the air with a knife. In the 1950s, and there were smog alert days, you know, 100 days of the year, and you could see a big pall of smog over the LA basin, and it didn't move because of temperature inversions. And in those days, we had incinerators, literally incinerators in our backyard. We'd take the garbage and we'd burn it. It'd go up in plume of smoke up into the air. And then one day, they sent out an edict saying, we're going to close down your incinerator. Some guys from the sanitation department came literally to our house, knocked on our door and said, we're going to dismantle your incinerator. And then they, you know, had the pollution controls for the cars, and they had the, you know, special, you know, gasoline formulations, and now efforts to use more hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles. And we're seeing somewhat of an improvement in air quality. It's not by no means clean. But the catastrophe that was developing in the 50s and 60s has been averted. And it's just amazing to me that even if you already have cancer, you're still more likely to die if you breathe bad air. That just blows my mind. This is a study that looks at the health benefits of volunteering. It's from the British Medical Journal. And it speaks to an issue that I think is of critical importance because more and more we're living longer. And more people who are older are considered obsolescent. And they're either fired from their jobs or they retire early, only to find that they are bored and they lack purpose and motivation. And I've had patients like that where retirement is literally a crisis for them, both from the standpoint of mental health, and that has an impact on their physical health. And many times I say to them, well, why don't you volunteer? You know, you were a successful executive or you were a successful automotive mechanic. Maybe, you know, in the case of someone who ran a successful automotive business, maybe you can go into a high school and volunteer and show young kids how to fix cars or offer that as a course at the local public library, you know, maybe adult education, because a lot of adults, they, you know, need some basic expertise to cope with their car situations. Well, this study looked at 66,000 person years. In other words, it wasn't 66,000 persons. It may have been 6,000 persons over 10 years or 3,000 persons over 20 years. Okay. They did something called a GHQ. It's a general health questionnaire. And in England, high values of this denote high mental disorder, and low values indicate relative mental health. And what they found is that there really wasn't much association between volunteering and well-being, as might be expected, in early adulthood to mid-adulthood. I think kids who do a lot of volunteering sometimes do it just to get brownie points to get into college. Correlation did become apparent above the age of 40 and continuing up to old age. So what they're saying is that there is really a therapeutic effect of volunteering, or the alternative explanation. They say that they were unable to determine whether there was selection bias because perhaps a person's poor health or poor mental health might have restricted their ultimate participation in volunteering later in life. In other words, it's selection bias or selection effect where, you know, if you're lonely and isolated and or you have poor self-esteem and, you know, just can't get it together to volunteer, you'll be less happy. So is it because you didn't volunteer or is it because you're just less happy to begin with. But there's a strong correlation between volunteering and good mental health. And so, you know, we really need to strengthen the apparatus that we have now for matching people with appropriate volunteer opportunities. There are such agencies around, and you can certainly do that through, you know, a church group or through a YMCA-type group. That can facilitate matching you with your appropriate skill base to a volunteer situation. You really feel like you can contribute and have an impact. And, you know, they say that one of the most selfish acts is altruism because, you know, it's ostensibly to benefit others, but clearly it has enormous benefits for you. So volunteer. If you're in a position to do so, it's going to give you great dividends. I remember in high school that I learned a poem by the American poet Walt Whitman, which has the line, "I sing the body electric." And, of course, Walt Whitman lived at the end of the 19th century, where electricity was a great, wondrous phenomenon. And he celebrated the industrialization and modernization of America in his poetry. But how true that is, as we come into the 21st century, because there's a fascinating article that I have here about how in the future we may treat conditions like rheumatoid arthritis with electrical stimulation. And I'll give you some background on this. There was a July 2016 study entitled Vagus Nerve Stimulation Inhibits Cytokine Production and Attenuates Disease Severity in Rheumatoid Arthritis. It appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And so let's help you out with this. Vagus nerve. Well, you may say, I haven't the vaguest idea what he's talking about. Well, the vagus is the biggest nerve in the body. And it's the term vagus, it's derived from, I think, the Latin, which has to do with wandering. It's a very circuitous nerve that goes from the brain down throughout the viscera. And it is responsible for regulation of your autonomic nervous system. And it produces something called acetylcholine, which in when they first discovered it, they called it vagus stoff. That's German for vagus material. But that was identified as the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. And it hooks up to the gut. It hooks up to the heart. It's responsible for your heart speeding up and slowing down. It's responsible for what's called autonomic tone, the balance between your sympathetic and your parasympathetic nervous system. And the vagus, in particular, puts out parasympathetic impulses. And so what are parasympathetic impulses? Well, parasympathetic impulses, oh, and by the way, it puts out, but it also receives. It actually conducts gut feelings to the brain. So literally, the state of your digestion, the composition of your microbiome is translated and transmitted by your vagus nerve to your brain. So, what in particular can be regulated by the vagus nerve, is inflammation. A higher vagal tone is linked to physical and psychological well-being. Conversely, a deficiency in vagal tone is associated with inflammation, depression, negative moods, loneliness, heart attacks, and stroke. They're already exploring vagal nerve stimulation with electrical devices for treatment of refractory depression and even epilepsy. The current study envisions the use of electrical stimulation to reduce the production of cytokines, and it really works. This is the first human study designed to reduce symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis by stimulating the vagus nerve with a small implanted device, which triggered a chain reaction that reduced cytokine levels and inflammation. And while this study was focused on rheumatoid arthritis, the trial's results may have implications for patients suffering from other inflammatory diseases, including Crohn's disease, but also brain disorders that are inflammatory in nature, like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. And so it's really quite fascinating that, and by the way, this is a drug-free approach, harnessing the self-regulatory effects of the human body. Now, you know, short of getting an electrical implant in your vagus, how do you actually do this in a less invasive way? Well, deep diaphragmatic breathing with the long, slow exhale has a nice effect on the vagus nerve. It slows heart rate, normalizes blood pressure, and also yoga has an impact on vagal tone, and so potentially does acupuncture. So, this is beginning to understand the link between the nervous system and the immune system and inflammation. And it's really quite fascinating. Maybe medicine of the future will be more reliant on these electrical interventions, singing the body electric. Okay, we've talked about how recent evidence shows that if you've had a heart attack, it's really beneficial to take fish oil. And when I shared that story with you, I pulled up an article that I remember sharing with our radio listeners back, I think it was in 2003, way back when, it just stuck out in my mind. I remembered it, that said that in Europe, if you have a heart attack, it's standard practice to administer fish oil. In fact, it's considered malpractice to omit administering fish oil. But here, it hasn't really caught on. But the study showed that there definitely were benefits in terms of reducing the risk of subsequent heart attacks or death if you took fish oil after a heart attack. So now comes evidence that omega-3s can be helpful in stroke. The research was published in a journal called PLOS-1. Researchers from Columbia University Medical Center found that omega-3 fatty acids reduced brain damage in a mouse model of stroke. So the way that they did this is that they actually injected an omega-3 emulsion, which, I mean, this is actually has to be done. You can't just inject it through a regular vein. I think you got to use a central catheter, because you really can't inject fats into small blood vessels, but large blood vessels can tolerate fatty emulsions. And so what they found was that, I mean, they did an intervention in these experimental animals, which caused an injury, a brain injury comparable to a stroke. And then the concern is that after a stroke, when the blood comes back, you get something called reperfusion injury. So it's actually the stroke knocks out some of the brain, but what is even more dangerous is reperfusion injury. It's a common cause of brain damage following the oxygen and nutrient deprivation that occurs after a stroke, because the brain is rendered more vulnerable to the effects of free radicals when the blood flow is restored, and oxygen promotes free radicals. So when it's actually the recovery of blood circulation is dangerous after a stroke. So they injected both EPA and DHA, and what they found is that the lipid emulsion containing DHA administered shortly after a stroke offers neuroprotective effects. And, you know, this is something which has yet to be undertaken in humans, but the animal studies suggest that this may be part of the invention. Why not? I mean, we do thrombolytic therapy in strokes. I mean, what they say is that when you have a stroke, it's very important to get to the hospital quick, because time is brain, some slogan along those lines. And the longer you wait before you get the rescue therapy, which is some kind of thrombolytic therapy, breaks the clot-busting therapy that they administer, the more likely you are to have a debilitating or irreversible brain damage with your stroke. So imagine if they could combine thrombolytic therapy with they're going to inject you anyway in the hospital. You're all plugged in anyway. So maybe they could run in some DHA while they're at it to help to preserve neurological and mitochondrial function after brain hypoxia. That's a pretty cool idea. And, you know, the other question that comes up is, let's say you have a stroke and you have been taking EPA and DHA. That should provide some protection as well. Just having some on board. It may not be as effective as running an IV of DHA emulsion. That's much more concentrated, but having consumed fish or having consumed a DHA rich, fish oil supplement, should help to limit the damage that occurs with stroke. And that's something that I've seen. A couple of my patients over time have had strokes. I mean, I can't prevent all calamity from happening in my patients, especially my older patients, but virtually all of them have had very mild reversible strokes. And virtually all of them are taking fish oil that's rich in DHA. And while it didn't completely prevent the stroke, most of them have recovered without long-term impairment. And that's a good thing. Okay, I was sitting with a patient this morning, and she comes in on crutches with a big, you know, boot on her foot. And, you know, it's like, whoa, what now? And I've been treating her for some other conditions, and then she says, hi, how are you doing? And she starts telling me a tale of woe. And apparently, she doesn't quite know how she did this. Maybe it was playing tennis. She managed to rupture a tendon in her foot. And it's extremely painful. And she's had a boot. She even had to have surgery to reattach it. She had what's called a cadaveric implant, which is like a tendon taken from a cadaver to knit together the rupture. It's a very serious and painful injury. And in the course of talking about it, she says, well, is it okay that I'm taking three Advils a day? And I made a face. And she said, what? You know, I said, well, you know, I think you may not want to do that. I know you need pain control. She said, yeah, well, the doctor gave me Tylenol with codeine, but he didn't want to give me any more of it because he thought I'd become addicted. And I said, well, you know, there's something to be said for that. It's like, you know, there's all these people who take these pain medications and then they can't get off them. So your doctor is either trying to cover his or her rear and not get you addicted, or because he's afraid that, you know, he's going to aid and abet your potential chronic dependency on these medications. He just doesn't want to do it. She asked him, well, can I take Advil? And he said, yeah, go ahead and take an Advil. But I pulled up an article for her that's actually an old article, and it's part of a trend that is in surgery and orthopedic medicine and sports medicine that is now looking askance at the use of anti-inflammatory medication. Now, when anti-inflammatory medication, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, Advil, she said it wasn't working well, so he gave me this, and she showed me a bottle of Naprosyn, which is even stronger, more likely to cause ulcers, more likely to cause leaky gut, which can then, you know, she had other problems that we thought were related to leaky gut syndrome prior to the injury. And so I said, this you shouldn't use. And, you know, unfortunately, there's going to be more pain, but I think it's important to minimize the use of NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. I'm reading here from this article entitled Anti-Inflammatory Management for Tendon Injuries, Friends or Foes. Acute and chronic tendon injuries are very common among athletes and in sedentary populations. Most physicians prescribe anti-inflammatory management to relieve the worst symptoms of swelling and pain, including non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, corticosteroids, and physical therapies. However, experimental research shows that pro-inflammatory mediators, such as prostaglandins, may play important regulatory roles in tendon healing. In other words, the inflammation is the way that you heal and knit together the tissue. Noticeably, nearly all cases of chronic tendon injuries we treat as specialists have received non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs by their physician, suggesting that there might be a potential interaction in some of these cases, turning a mild inflammatory tendon injury into chronic tendinopathy in predisposed individuals. In other words, you know, makes it worse. We're aware of the fact that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and corticosteroids, like prednisone, may well have a positive effect on the pain control in the clinical situation, whilst negatively affect the structural healing. In other words, you feel better, but the healing is impaired. It follows that a comprehensive evaluation of anti-inflammatory management for tendon injuries is needed, and any such data would have profound clinical and health economic importance. So, where they go into the physiology of healing, and when they actually find that the use of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs may cause the healing process to be impaired. because these drugs work on prostaglandins, but there's a double-edged effect. Prostaglandins cause pain, but prostaglandins also help to suppress certain factors that are conducive to healing. Okay? So, you know, what's the alternative? Well, you know, if you have an injury, I recommend that you take something like Wobenzyme. This is potent bioflavonoids. You could take Pycnogenol. The Wobenzymes contains proteolytic enzymes that break up some of the complexes that literally gum up the works, you know, the cellular debris that accumulates at an injury site. And they promote circulation, reduce swelling. But they don't act as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They don't block inflammation. Some people will say, oh my goodness, you know, well, I'm taking all these natural anti-inflammatories like curcumin, for example. Will that impair healing? Actually, curcumin has been shown to be ideal for tendon injuries and does not exhibit the harmful effects of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Besides, it's much milder. I mean, it will reduce, you can generally notice a dramatic reduction in pain when you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. If you take curcumin, that may take longer and the effect is more subtle. So it's really not such a complete blocker of inflammation. And what I explained to this lady was, you know, I broke my hip a few years back and I experienced the healing process. And I was told explicitly by my surgeon, who was, it was 2006, and he already knew then that you shouldn't take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs when you're trying to heal. So I asked him, just innocently said, well, now that I'm off these other, you won't give me any more Tylenol with codeine. What can I take? Can I take some Advil? He said, no, don't take that. They can actually impair healing. And I said, okay. So I was left virtually without anything. Maybe, you know, it's an over-the-counter Tylenol to take, which didn't do much for the pain. But I kind of reframed the pain. And I thought, wow, you know, the cells are going there and they're working hard and blood flow is happening there. And there's some repair crew at work in my hip. And rather than framing it as, oh my God, you know, I'm in a lot of pain and that means that I'm not healing properly, I put my faith in nature that the natural process of healing was ongoing there, and there's an army of little white blood cells and healing humors were going to work to knit my lacerated tissue and my shattered bone. And, you know, gradually the pain abated. And you know, sure enough, 10 years later, there's no vestige whatsoever of pain, and it healed beautifully. So, something that we need to look at, I've also shared with you some articles that suggest that higher doses of vitamin C may help with pain. Higher doses of vitamin D may be associated with pain reduction. There's a condition called chronic regional pain syndrome that may respond to vitamin C to some extent. Again, it's not like a magic narcotic, but it may just take down your threshold of pain a little bit, you want to raise your threshold for pain so that it requires more stress for your body to experience pain. These are some suggestions that I recommend to patients who are healing injuries. But consider something like a proteolytic enzyme, Wobenzyme, Pycnogenol is also excellent for swelling, grapeseed extract as a cheaper, alternative to Pycnogenol. These are some of the things that you can do for soft tissue, injuries and tendon, inflammation. Oh, it's just parenthetically, big article in New York Times recently about how, you know, people with tennis elbows, that's a classic case of tendinopathy. They get steroid injections. It is now, and it does relieve the pain temporarily, but that pain comes back almost uniformly. And they're really, and you know, it's don't just stand there, do something, give me a shot, doc. Well, the net result is not good because it will weaken and thin the tendons. And ultimately, you know, if you get too many of those, you can get a tendon rupture. Not the way to go for, so-called tennis elbow or tendinopathy. that pretty much sums up what I wanted to share with you today. I apologize for going a little long. I hope you found it interesting and rewarding. Please join us for our clinical focus podcast and our interviews. And from time to time, we'll do one of these potpourris and catch up on some of the stories that we weren't able to share with you on our weekend radio program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Stay well.